You have talents, which you should use, but when? Like acrobatics. They start training when they're four. Is that really necessary? Or should they first grow up a little bit?
Okay, but the people who, the acrobatics who started training in the four, I don't even know if they have a talent for it or if it's just they've been trained to do it. Like, I'm talking about someone who clearly has
a real talent.
A natural
talent.
That, like, it's obvious, like, it comes out by itself. Like, right. You see them doodling on their paper, you see them writing,
right.
Or whatever.
So
it is.
How much time should they put into it when they're four? Or 12? Or 15? You know, everything has its time.
But what's.
So you're saying you should use your talent to serve Hashem. So first you have to find out what is Hashem. Then you have to find out what is served. Then you use your talent. But to devote your time constantly to your talent, there's got to be a time for everything. So, David HaMelech played his harp. Yeah, but there was a time when he was just a shepherd. And then there was a time when he was too busy because he had to go fight wars. I mean, there's a time for... But this is true for sure, that not using your talents is an aveira. Because, like you say, they gave it to you for a reason. Now, it could be for some people that the talent that they have is actually a nesayon, and that their mitzvah or their whatever, their avodah is to sacrifice that talent to have mesiras nefesh by giving up that fame that they could have or the whatever wealth that they could have if they use their talent. You see, the Rebbe sends people on shlichas and they're working so hard. They have to pay the bills for the Chabad house and then the sewer backs up, and now they have to run and take care of a sewer. And, you know, and these guys, many of them, could be Rosh Hashivas. They could be having, you know, an easy life because they're big Talmid Chachamim. They could be famous. They could be writing Svarim. And Rebbe puts them to work, paying bills in the Chabad house, raising money.
There's some people who would be happy to do that. I'm saying, I feel like it's such a waste for someone to be doing that. I'm not saying that there's no place for it, but there obviously is a place where it has to get done, but I don't think the people who could be Rosh Yeshiva should be fixing sewers. Why?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds right, but what was that famous story about Rabbi Yosef Balagoa? You know that story?
Yeah.
Okay, but he's like unique. It's not, like, they're not clearly told him to do that.
But why? The man's got a talent. Let him use his talent. He's not good at driving a wagon. But sometimes you have to give up.
So how do you know when you're supposed to give up and when you're just supposed to... when you're just doing the wrong thing and you're actually supposed to use your talents? Do you have to have some
Rosh Hashivas
and stuff?
somebody's gotta do it.
Like, there is a thing that, like, so many talented people, everyone goes on shlachos. Like, the people who really have their shkafa straight, of course, the one thing that they want the most is to go on shlachos, and then they leave Crown Heights. And then what's Crown Heights left with, for example? And that's also, those are the Rebbe's children. If anything, that's more precious to the Rebbe, because that's
his own kids. Yeah, that's a whole different issue.
That's not true. That's the exact same thing. Like, someone saying, I have the talent to be a teacher or whatever, but I'm going to go out, I'm going to teach. I'm going to go and I'm going to sacrifice myself. I'm going to go out, I'm going to pay the bills, I'm going to do all those things, and I'm going to teach, not from people, while I could have a job in Alitair.
So, you need some people to teach it there.
So let's stick to the issue. The issue is, do you always go with your talent, or do you sometimes put your talent aside and do something more important? Obviously, You can't always follow your talent. Let's say, for example, somebody is very talented, but their wife needs to live in a certain place where the air, you know, for her, whatever, asthma. So he can't do what he's good at. He has to go. You know? So of course he should. In other words, we're saying you should never waste your talent. You should always use it for... Well, not always. There's got to be a time when you can't, and you have to do something more important. Is nothing more important? Of course there could be. So we're not saying that you must follow your talent. What we're saying is you must not ignore your talent. But when you can't follow it, then you don't follow it. So what is it there for? For you to give it up. To not be selfish. So how do we know when to follow it and when to give it up? You ask a Rebbe or a Mashpia, or you see what the Hashgacha Pratis does. There was a woman in Beis Chanan a lot of years ago. She was a dancer. Ballet, whatever, classical dance. And she trained from a very young age. Very professional, and so on and so on. So she started probably when she was six. And she was really good. And at the age of, I think, 22 or something, she was in a car accident and broke her hip. And her dancing was over. And it bothered her so much, this question. If I'm not meant to dance, then why was I given that talent and then it was taken away? Why did I put so much time into it and now it's gone? She couldn't understand. What is this? And it really disturbed her. She was miserable. Not because she wanted to dance, but because it didn't make sense. If I don't dance, fine. I put 20 years into this. She went and asked rabbis and teachers and professors, and their answers, she didn't like it. One night, she had a dream, and her grandfather came to her in the dream, and he said to her a few words. He said, "Live your life the way you were taught to dance." That was her answer. She was happy. A talent can be expressed in many ways. What is the talent of dance? That you have strong legs and you can jump up and down? That's not a talent. The talent of dance is that you have a sense of gracefulness, of how... I'm not going to the whole thing. How lines and circles work together. So you move in a straight line, then you move in a circle, and it all blends together beautifully. And the same as in painting. When you're painting, you're making a bunch of lines, but you make them so perfectly in harmony with each other that it turns out beautiful. So the grandfather said to her, when you were taught to appreciate the beauty of movement and the grace of you think you do that only on a stage when people are watching. That's how you live life. Oh, wow, that's good. So you can say, like, your whole life is a dance. Live like a dancer, not like a klutz. By the way, this is one dimension, one aspect of tznius. When a person moves without, you know, without gracefulness, it's like klutzy. That's not tznius. Tznius means natural, graceful. Yeah? like the difference between a dog and a cat. When a dog runs, you can see he's busy. No, he's very serious. He's running, he's puffing, he's... When a cat runs, it looks like he's not doing anything. He's just so graceful. And he's running as fast as he can, but it looks like he's making no effort at all. That's what sneas means. When a person does a mitzvah, and he's so obnoxious about it, you know, so everybody notices, it's such a big deal. Everybody's got to stop doing what they're doing. I'm going to do a mitzvah now. That's not sneas. Sneas means you do it, and it's so natural, and it fits, all the parts come together so naturally that you hardly notice. That's the difference between a chitzen and a pnimi. A person who is a chitzen, everything's on the outside. When he does something, everybody has to notice. Because he does it so klutzy that it disturbs everything. So everybody's got to stop. Because he is now going to do something important. To him. A person who's a pnimi, it means that the mitzvahs that he does is so much part of him. It flows with him. So you don't even notice that he's doing anything special. Which is the only way to explain when you watch the Rebbe daven. Davening is avodah, avodah shebelev. You watch the Rebbe daven, he's not doing anything. He's not doing anything. Nothing's happening. And at the end of every davening, the Rebbe is a different person. Oh, where did that change take place? I was watching. I didn't see anything happen. Because it happens so real. It is so graceful. So, what does graceful mean? Let's work it that way. Obviously, when you have a straight line, and then above that you have a curved line, it's stark. So wait, straight or curved? There's a conflict here. There's a straight line and a curved line. They're not the same. Which way should it be? Should all lines be curved or should all lines be straight? But when you have two curved lines and they follow exactly the same curve, that's called graceful. There's no conflict here. They work together. That's called graceful. In other words, they fit with each other. Now you have a person who's basically a very loud, you know, I'm sure you've had this experience. And this person comes over to you and says, can I tell you a secret? The whole room just heard that. Then he turns around and tells everybody to move away. I need private. The whole world all of a sudden has to know that you're going to tell a secret. You have a secret. Nobody can hear your secret. If it's a secret, treat it like a secret. Be graceful. Make the lines match. Your tone of voice should match what you're saying. That's called graceful. It's like, well, thanks. Did you just scream at me or did you just thank me? I don't know. I can't make up. When you say thank you, shouldn't it like sound like thank you? When you say please, should it sound like please or should it sound like, will you please? You're asking me, you're telling me. Your words are asking, your tone is telling. So when a Jew does a mitzvah, it should be graceful. It should fit with the rest of him. Because when it doesn't, then it's so obvious. It's so, what is the word? Conspicuous. It's so... It draws attention. Because, whoa, what happened? He's not the type that does that. But when it's an incredible story. You know, we tell all sorts of stories about the Rebbe or about other Rebbes that are, you know, really miraculous, unusual. But the most powerful, the most amazing stories are the simple ones that people don't notice. The Rebbetzin, the Rebbe's mother, I think wrote the story or told the story that when the Rebbe needed to go to the Friedrich Rebbe before he was married, so the Rebbetzin accompanied him on the train halfway, I think. They traveled all night. Came in the morning, the Rebbe took out his tefillin, started putting on his tefillin. Now that was very dangerous. In public, on a train, under Stalin. So the Rebbetzin writes, I was very frightened. But an interesting thing happened. The people on the train, the passengers, stood up and got into a conversation, but the way they were standing blocked the Rebbe from the conductor's view. So when he came by, he didn't see the Rebbe. They stood like this until the Rebbe took off his tulle, and then they sat down. I don't know who these people were. She didn't know them. They were not friends. They were not, maybe not even Jewish. And they stood up to protect the Rebbe. So fine, that's a story. Beautiful, no? Very nice. But you stop and think. Why would they do that? They didn't know the Rebbe. They were communists. Why would they protect somebody? May even have been dangerous for them. If the conductor realized that they were part of this whole thing, they also could have been arrested. So let's say the Rebbe decided to put on tefillin because I don't care. I'm brave. Fine, arrest me. I'm putting on my tefillin. If that was what the Rebbe was feeling, then the people around him would have said, okay, good. So get yourself arrested. They wouldn't stand up and protect it. If the Rebbe put on the tefillin because he's frum, because he's so frum, and it's time to put on tefillin, so now he's going to do his frum thing, and he's going to put on tefillin, what effect would that have on the people around him? They would say, you want to be frum? We don't believe in that. Not in this country. We don't believe in religion. You want to be religious? Well, then we're not interested in you. What did they feel? What did they see that made them want to protect or, in a sense, be part of what the Rebbe was doing? The only possible explanation is that they saw somebody being so real. He wasn't being frum. He wasn't being brave. He wasn't being rebellious. He wasn't a refusnik. He wasn't a political activist disagreeing with the government. None of that. It was morning. In the morning, you put on tefillin. It was so natural, so real, so graceful, that it drew everybody into it. Like a beautiful painting, like a beautiful dance. And that can be called tznius. It's one aspect of tznius. Tznius means not everybody has to know what you're feeling, Not everybody has to see how frum you are. Make it natural. Like that story where there were two girls standing by the door of 770. Huh? On Shabbos, yeah. The story, the Rebbe was coming up the steps of 770, and right by the door, there were two girls standing on both sides of the door. Huh?
Little girls?
No, no, no. The Rebbe didn't want to walk between them, because he's frum. So, what would other people do? Uh-huh. Yeah. Where's the frumman? No, no! That's called Yiddish. The Rebbe walked over to one of them, just naturally walked over to one of them and said, go tell your friend good Shabbos for me. You have to... I'm frum! Out of my way! Come on, where's your tznius? Does everything have to be so up, you know, in your face? So vulgar? Yeah, it's your frum. You have to announce it to the world. So, for example, if these girls really didn't know about tznius, and the Rebbe says to one of them, go tell your friend, good Shabbos. And then you ask this girl, oh, you know that was the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Is it really? You see how frum he is? No. She doesn't see. Don't you realize what he just did was very frum? No. He just asked me to say the Shabbos. That's called sneeze. So... A girl dresses non-sneers. It's like an announcement. Did you notice that I'm a girl? You didn't notice? Why do I have to notice? You're a girl. But what is the announcement? You comes time to put on film. You put on film. What are you making announcements for? You're doing something special? So if it's not natural for you to put on tefillin, then it will stand out and be... If it's not natural for you to be a girl, then you have to do something to convince the world that you are. Why isn't it natural? So be naturally feminine. Don't push it. You don't have to push. Naturally. Gracefully. You know the Rebbetzin drove. The Rebbe never drove a car. The Rebbetzin did. One time the Rebbetzin came to 770 in her car, and there were some bachurim standing by the steps, and they were like staring. The Rebbetzin. The Rebbetzin walked past them to the door, so she said over her shoulder, you never saw a lady driver? Like, what are you staring at? I'm a lady driver, what? In those days it was, you know, women drivers was not so common. But instead of the Rebbetzin saying, oh, I'm the Rebbetzin, right? You're staring at me because I'm the Lubavitcher. What are you looking at? I drive a car, okay. So every talent is a lifestyle. It's not just a job or an activity. In fact, painting or drawing. What is that talent? What is this talent of, I see your face, give me a minute, and I make your face? I can't do that. Why? What am I missing? I can see, and I can handle a pen. Why can't I do what the artist does?
The connection of the actual seeing and putting it into action, like putting what you can see into action.
What does that take? What does it take to be able to do that? Break it down to steps. First, I see you. That's pure gashmius. Now, I want to take what I saw and make another reproduction of that. When I reproduce it and I have the drawing, that's gashmius. But how did it go from one gashmius to another gashmius? How did it go from a person to a paper? In order to be able to do that, I have to be able to go from gashmius, ruchnius, gashmius. I have to take what I see begashmius, create a ruchniusdike reality, and then turn that ruchnisdika reality back into a gashmi, but a different gashmi. You can't go from one gashmi to another gashmi. I mean, I can't take somebody's face and put it on paper. So I have to first turn the gashmis into ruchnis, then I have to turn the ruchnis back into gashmis, and then I can turn it into whatever gashmis I want. I can either make a drawing, I can make a painting, I can make a sculpture. The ability to go from gashmius to ruchnius, from ruchnius to gashmius, that is so holy. A person who is stuck in gashmius can't do it. A person who is good at ruchnius but not gashmius can't do it. So the ability to form a mental or spiritual image of something gashmis, and then take that mental spiritual image and turn it back into a gashmi. That's a person who can do that should also be able to. A person who can do that with art should also be able to do that in her life. Like, for example, I see somebody who behaves in a way that I don't understand. What? Why do they do that? Why do they act like that? So, I can't deal with them. I can't talk to them. I can't communicate. They're strange. This even happens between husband and wife. But then I sit back and I say, wait a minute. Every person has his own thing, and every person. So I take it away from the gashmis. And I make it a thought, an opinion. Every person is entitled to be what they want to be, and every person has their own neshama and their own shlichus, and each person accomplishes what they're supposed to accomplish in their own unique way, and it doesn't really matter as long as you get to the right place in the end, and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, yeah, I can talk to you. Yes, I can tolerate you. I can be your friend. So again, what did I do? I took a gashmis, I turned it into a ruchnis, and now I'm back into the gashmis. But now the gashmis is better. So that's another way in which live your life the way your art works. Now, in art, there are different talents. Some people are very talented in taking a gashmi into a ruchni. They're really great at that. But then when they try to turn the ruchni back into gashmi, so if you ask an expert, they'll tell this person, you have a great artistic talent, but you don't have a good technique. In other words, you have a great idea, you have a great vision, you have a great, but you don't make it happen. Your hand doesn't work so good. Your technique. What do you need technique for? To turn a ruchni into a gashmi. For that, you need tools, you need the right paints, you need the right canvas, you need the right eye-hand coordination, fine motor skills. This is, some people are very good at turning ruchnis into gashmis because they have the skills. But what they're turning into gashmis is not so ruchnisdik, because they're not good at that. So for example, some painters, they see a picture, they paint it, and it's perfect. Nothing ruchnis about it. They saw a book and they painted a book. They saw a flower, they made a flower. There's no ruchnisdike talent. In other words, what is the artist showing you? A book. Sometimes an artist in the painting brings out something you don't see when you look at a book. Because of the shading and the light and the color combination, it doesn't just show you a book. It creates a mood. He captured the mood. Like, for example, this library is not bad looking. Sometimes you look at a shelf of books. Books. Red books, white books, blue books. And you don't realize that looking at those books has put you into a bad mood. Because they're not straight. The colors don't work together, they clash. And just seeing them put you in a bad mood. You didn't even notice. A painter notices the mood. I say, wait a minute, I gotta show people this mood. So what he's putting down on the canvas is not books. He's putting down on the canvas a mood. Now, anyone looking at his painting will get into a bad mood. We'll walk away upset. You see, there are different kinds of paintings. Some people are master painters because their technique is so perfect. They don't have to show you anything unusual. But the way they paint a book, wow, it's perfect. Some artists, they don't want to paint a book. They want to show you a mood, a thought, an idea. Their technique is not so perfect. So, the difference is, there's an Eir and there's a Keli. Some people are better with the Eir, and not so good with the Keli. And some people are really good with the Keli, and not so good with the Eir. And then there are the real masters, they're good at both.
What is that? Details and big picture?
What they want to show is something ruchnizdik, and their ability to paint and use colors is tops.
No, I mean, what is Eir and
Keli? Eir and Keli, yeah. Eir is the message, and Keli is the technique. The Eir is Ruchnis and the technique is Gashmis. So how well can you combine and go from Ruchni to Gashmi, Gashmi to Ruchni? So when the Alter Rebbe learned Chassidus with the Malach, the other night we met a guy. His name is something Angel. Who was it? I forget his first name. Something Angel. And he says that he's an inicle of the Alter Rebbe. Where does the name Angel come from? From a Bavram Malach. Bavram the Malach, they turned it into a family name. Anyway, so when, you know what I'm talking about? The Malach? Rebbe Avram? Rebbe Avram was the Magid's son. And he was so holy that they called him the Malach. So when the Alter Rebbe came to the Magid, they made an arrangement that the Alter Rebbe would teach Rebbe Avraham Gemara, and Rebbe Avraham would teach the Alter Rebbe Chassidus, the Baal Shem Tov's. So after they finished learning Chassidus, the Malach would be very excited, ecstatic. And he saw the Alter Rebbe, after learning the Maimah, the Alter Rebbe went and he was eating a bagel. The Malach couldn't believe it. He said, after what we just learned, how could you eat? But the Alter Rebbe forced him, pushed him. Finish a Maimah, you eat a bagel. Later, the Magid thanked the Alter Rebbe, which rewarded him with a maimer or something, because the effect that he had on the Malach gave him 5 more years of life. Because he would have died young if the Alter Rebbe hadn't pushed him to. In other words, the Malach couldn't go from Ruchnius to Gashmius. There wasn't a harmony there. They were so different. Ruchnis is so different from Gashmis. It took him a long time before he could readjust and actually eat something which is so Gashmis. By the Alter Rebbe, Ruchnis, Gashmis, it's all the Eibishter. It flowed together. So it's not like, well, after you finish learning a maimer, okay, now your ruchnius is over, now you got to go into gashmius. It's not ruchnius and it's not gashmius. It's a lukus. The learning is a lukus and the bagel is a lukus. So it was harmonious, it was graceful, it was. So what else is interesting?
Love that so much, then why would we want to do what we're supposed to do, which is, like, I feel like it's a little bit of like a tease, like, okay, for these 4 years we're gonna be able to be like learning or whatever, and then afterwards, and I also had this discussion with someone, and we, like, even though it's supposed to be because girls need to like have your shemayim or whatever, I feel like some things that we learn don't necessarily I don't think necessarily enhance it, so then why do we have to.
Like what?
What?
Like what?
you're going to tell me, everyone, that, like, it actually doesn't answer your soul? Because, I mean, I know it's true, but it still does feel, it still feels like we're taught to learn so intensely for a few years, and then go on and, like, change kids' diapers. Yeah. And, of course, you could keep learning, but you can't keep learning like you were when you were in high school or before you were married.
I think you're right. There's something fishy about this.
So we should learn less or we should learn more? It's like who you are, but I know. It's not even like you used to.
Let me put it in different words. No, no matter how much you learn, it's never enough. There's no limit on how much to learn. You should know less. Never know less. There's no virtue in knowing less. I think the problem is like this. Full-time, heavy learning is not just gathering information. You're sitting in high school or in seminary. You are, for those years, you are a learner. And then all of a sudden, you're a diaperer. It's shocking. So it's not how much you learn, what you learn. It's, wait a minute, am I a learner or am I a housemaker? The identity part of it. So even if you're learning a lot, don't become a learner. So it would probably be a good idea that even in seminary, where you're supposed to be learning full time, learn a lot, but do other things so that you don't get this identity of being a learner. Even if you enjoy it. But your life today, who you are today and who you're going to be tomorrow, should not be so different. It's shocking. It's culture shock. So who am I really? So I'm a learner for a bunch of years, and all of a sudden I'm a diaper. It really does feel terrible.
What's the point in learning then? It's really true. I never thought about that. You learn to be able enough. Everyone's trying to teach you how to. So you can learn on your own, like they try to teach you so well so that you'll be able to learn on your own, but you won't be able to learn on your own really after.
World preparation and things that you need to know,
Well, let's say before Shem and Chumash, like we're learning so much so that we can like just open up Chumash and learn, like that's the goal. So I don't even get the point.
Why is that the goal?
That's why you say the goal.
Why is that the goal?
We're trying to get an education here. Like, for most people, like so you can go to college so that you can get a good job.
Right.
Just for the sake of learning Torah, I don't know, like we're trying to learn just so that we can learn well, and then but we won't be able to use our skills.
Yeah. In college, you learn well so that you can get a job. But if you're a woman, you learn, you get a job, you have a career, and then you got a diaper the baby. Frustrates people. And that's why there's the big debate. Should I have a career? Should I be a housewife? Because it's not that I don't have enough time for both. It's that I don't know who I am. My identity is confused. Am I a career or am I a mother? And when people say, well, how can you balance both? You can do 10 things at a time, but you can't be two different things. So, who am I is the disturbing question. Now, with a yeshiva, a girl's yeshiva, the goal is that you should be able to learn by yourself.
It's one of the goals. You're trying to get, like, it can't just be about self-esteem and your shema. It also has to be you're in school. You want to have, like, an accomplishment. If you want to actually say that I can learn this, like, my brain actually developed. What's the point? I mean, I guess maybe that's why girls don't go to school.
So if your brain actually developed, what are you doing diapering babies? You didn't need a brain for that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, why should we learn about, like, a spinosaurus, let's say, if we're never going to have a chance to have a spinosaurus until our kids are out of the house? Like,
well, you can be Miss Bina while you're diapering a baby. Just don't forget what you're doing. I think it would be much healthier if the goal of learning in a seminary is to be able to teach, not to be able to learn more. For a bacher, it makes sense. Learn as best you can in yeshiva so that you'll be able to continue learning after yeshiva. That's not for a girl. For a girl, it should be learn a lot so that you'll be able to teach a lot. Why? Teaching is nurturing. Teaching is like diapering in some way, if you use your imagination. But there's lilmeid ulilameid, or there's lilmeid lishma. To learn for the sake of learning, not a girl should never do that. Totally confusing.
Why?
Because her life is about giving, not about getting. It's a long story. But basically, being a mother means that you nurture. If you have a lot of information, you can nurture. Not for yourself. To give to others. The truth is, in Chabad, a bocher should do the same thing. We don't believe in sitting in kollel all your life. You learn in order to be able to teach. What does it mean to teach? When you're teaching, you can either be masculine or you can be feminine. So first of all, receiving and nurturing are the same thing. Because when you receive, you don't do anything. You're just letting it happen. And when you're nurturing, you're not doing anything. When you walk into your house, you feel nurtured. Before you do anything, before your mother says anything, you come home, that's it. That's nurturing. I mean, if that's how you feel when you come home. Just being there gives you energy, gives you pleasure. That's called nurturing. If you're expecting your mother to do something to nurture you, that's not nurturing. That's just activity. Like, for example, when the baby starts to grow in the uterus, in the womb, what does the worm, what does the womb do? What does the womb do to make the baby grow? It receives it, and that makes it grow. In other words, if you let it into your life, you're going to give it life. That's called receiving and nurturing. It's the same thing. It's like you put a seed in the ground, in the earth. What does the earth do to produce a tree? Observe carefully. What is the earth doing?
Nothing.
Never see anything bubbling or cooking. Nothing, and all of a sudden there's a tree. That's called nurturing, because Mother Earth is a nurturer. That's why it's called Mother Earth. So receiving and nurturing are really the same thing. We think nurturing means being busy, diapering, feeding. No, just being a mother nurtures. So we think nurturing is a bunch of activity, and it's not. And we think receiving is doing nothing, and it's not. So receiving is nurturing, and nurturing is as passive as receiving. So if you have to convince your child that you love her, you're not a good nurturer, and you're never going to convince her. Because that should happen effortlessly, without activity. Now, the same is true when you're sharing what you know. Are you being aggressive? Come here, I got to teach you something. Or you let somebody in, you know the expression? Let me let you in on a secret. Let you in. If you let somebody in to share your life, which is full of information, then you're a great teacher. What are you doing, Mama? So there's the masculine teaching, and there's the feminine teaching. We think that when you go to kindergarten, they teach you how to get along. Right? What are the skills? Anybody, kindergarten teachers here? In kindergarten, you are taught cooperation. You're taught teamwork. You're taught etiquette, to say thank you and to be polite and so on and so forth. Actually, before you get to kindergarten, your mother already taught you that. Oh, your mother's a teacher? No? She's your mother. And before you get to kindergarten, she already taught you to get along. She already taught you to say thank you. She already taught you to have, you know, good manners. But everybody thinks that it happens in kindergarten.
Some
kindergartens don't either. So there are failures everywhere.
It means more like the goal, not necessarily what people do. People sometimes don't get interested.
And it's also the ability. A mother has the ability, even if she doesn't do it, a mother has the ability to educate her kids without ever doing anything. And nobody would ever say, oh, she's a good teacher. No, she's not. She's a mother. But whatever information she has, whatever knowledge she has, in some natural, effortless, and invisible way, gets passed on to her children. And the same is true in a Chabad house, in influencing people into Yiddishkeit. It's not because you said something brilliant or you sat down for an hour and drilled some Pasuk or Piddush into their heads. Your knowledge is so much a part of you. What you know is what you are. So when a person starts to get close to you and likes you and is impressed with you, they're impressed with what you know, they're impressed with what you understand, they're impressed with all the knowledge you gained in school. They don't notice because it's sneezdik. It's graceful. But we should know, if you sit down to ask yourself, why am I learning this stuff? You have to have an answer. And the answer should be so that my information and my knowledge will influence those who come into my life.
So is everything just for the men? Because like the women are giving an order, are getting an order to be able to give, and the heard their daughters are only there to give, like, they're not there for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So the men are really the only ones that are taking it just for themselves. Like, the women are sort of transparent, like, they're not even there.
We're the only ones who get to be selfish. Jealous?
We probably, like that.
Alright, you're jealous? But that's the point. The Rebbe doesn't let men or boys be like that.
So who are we giving? Who's getting then if everyone's giving? Someone has to get.
Kids.
Everybody.
And they're just getting in order to.
Everybody is a mashpia to somebody, and everybody is a makabel from somebody. There's constant exchange going on. But
they're not the only ones that are taking it and keeping it.
Who?
The men. They're
not Lubavitchers. If they do that, they're not the Rebbe's chassidim. I mean, the Rebbe is so impatient with teaching. He said, if you learn an aleph, before you even learn the beis, you learned an aleph, go teach somebody about the aleph. Well, shouldn't I wait until I at least get to yud? No. You know something, teach it. Why else do you know it? Huh? That's how you know it, right? But that you don't have, that you're learning without planning to teach, that's not Chabad. Again, not everybody has to be a teacher. But the reason you're accumulating knowledge is not just for yourself. So in that way, even men are a little more feminine.
What does learning Lishma mean?
The real learning Lishma has to do with the Eibishter. Not with you, not with others, not with... Real learning Lishma means this is my way of getting closer to the Eibishter. So Lishma should really be Lishmoy. I'm doing it for the Eibishter. But then there's Lilmeid, Ulalameid, Lishmer, Velasei, Sulakayim. There are many purposes for learning. But Lilmeid, Ulalameid, that's absolutely necessary. In today's generation, if you're the Rebbe Shliach, if you're the Rebbe's Chassid, it's got to be Lilmeid, Ulalameid. Lilmeid al menas lilamed.
You can't teach something over properly if it didn't pass through you properly, if you didn't learn it in order for you to learn it for yourself.
True.
Like, your intention can't even be when you're learning something to be able to give it over to someone else, because you're not learning it properly.
Because it has to be you.
Or learn it as well as you need to teach it to someone else.
People receive things from the heart, so they'll receive something that you internalize yourself, not something you have from someone else.
That is very wise. It's true. But it's a difference in purpose and style. How do you learn? If the method, the way you're learning, is in order to teach, then you're skipping something. It's going to be very shallow. Because your way of learning is to be thinking of somebody else. Like, for example, we're sitting in Beis Chana, we're talking about something, and that Jews are really different from non-Jews. And this girl says, but you can't say that. So, what do you mean you can't say that? Do you agree or not? She says, yeah, fine. I can accept that, but I can imagine telling my friends, it's not going to go over big. So, you're already telling your friends? So you haven't even finished the thought And you're already worried, what are your friends going to say? That's shallow, and it's not going to work, and it's not. When you're learning, learn. Your purpose, not your method, your purpose in learning is to teach. And in the back of your mind, you have to be conscious of that.
But isn't it also to live that way? For yourself?
I mean, and for others.
But it shouldn't be.
And for the others. When you teach the others, you don't want them to just read the book. You want them to live that way. Which is also, if you learn and it changes your life, then when you teach, it'll change their life. If you learn and it doesn't affect you, then when you teach, it's not going to affect them either.
But shouldn't it be that the goal is to affect yourself and to get closer to Hashem as a natural result?
Okay, so let me put it in different words. Your goal is to get closer to Hashem by learning and affecting yourself, but you're not selfish about it. It's not for yourself. That's what's supposed to happen. Or if you want to put it in very humble terms, a person is learning and it's really great and it's brilliant and it's deep and it's affecting you, and you ask yourself, what did I do to deserve this? Am I so special that I'm privileged to learn all this? What is the answer? Who says it's for you? Don't get arrogant about it. It's not that you are so special that you deserve to know this. Well, maybe.
But you're lucky to be the messenger.
That, yes. But a messenger means I am not the most important person. It's the person I'm delivering to that is most important.
You could say that with anybody. But I'm giving it to someone, I'm the messenger, now the person becomes a messenger also.
Shliach is a shliach. Yeah, it's a chain. So there's a secret behind all of this. It's a very important secret, so don't tell anybody. If you want to be effective, if you want to succeed in any of this, whether it's lilmaid or lilamaid, whether it's to become smarter or to become better, whether it's to use your talents or to give up your talents, whatever it is, if you're not happy doing it, then go home. Because you're ruining everything.
Huh? That's it with school.
That's it with school. Go home. If you're not doing it b'simcha, nothing's working. Nothing is working. If you're not enthusiastic, if you're not excited, and I don't mean jumping up and down, I mean sneezdik excited. Natural excitement. Graceful excitement. If you're not excited, then you're not doing anything. So the sadness or the heaviness is ruining everything. So the Baal Shem Tov invented this idea, and the Alter Rebbe explains it, and Chassidus has practiced it for 300 years. You got to be happy. About what? You need an excuse to be happy? About what? About nothing. You got to be happy. Well, what is there to be happy about? Don't start with your depressing thoughts. You're supposed to be happy. And when you're happy, you do good things to be more happy about. But you don't have to do anything to be happy. You're supposed to be happy just to be here. Or you're supposed to be happy about the fact that if you really wanted to, you could actually do something that would make you happy. In other words, you were invited to this party. What has happened so far at the party? Nothing. So you're not happy yet? You were invited. Be happy. Yeah, but I haven't done anything. But you were invited. So if you want to do something, you can. In fact, you can do anything. The whole party is there for you. Eat whatever you want, drink whatever you want. It's your party. Yeah, but I haven't had anything to eat. Stop kvetching. You're at a party and you're invited. You want to eat? Go ahead. You haven't eaten? So go eat. You can't eat? So just smile because you were invited. Make sense? The Eibishter had a big plan. He created a world. He has a big vision. It's going to become a Dira B'Tachtonim, and he made you part of that plan. Yeah, but what is there to be happy about? You're so ungrateful. You're such an ungracious guest. You were invited. Yeah, but I'm not a tzaddiker. I was invited to the party, but you didn't give me a seat up front. I didn't get one of those little hats.
You're saying he's focusing on the positive. Huh? I still furry in that. What you're saying is focus on the positive, that you were invited or whatever. But that's still for something.
No,
it's
not something you did. Usually people say, what did I do? I have nothing to be happy about. No, not about what you do. What was done for you, given to you. You were invited. The rest is details. You invite somebody over to come over to your house. They come in with their little suitcase and they say, thank you so much. You say, for what? You haven't eaten anything yet? You haven't? What are they thanking you for?
For what's
going to For letting them through the door. You let me into your door? Thank you so much. Because you don't let just anybody into your door. Yeah, suppose you're invited to a party and you can't go.
You're not as happy.
Not as happy.
But you're not happy. Like, if you're invited to your cousin's wedding, let's say. So you're excited that you're invited and then you can't go to the wedding. So you're happy that it's happening. That's a different idea because it's a wedding.
No, you're happy that you were invited. Because imagine you find out that your cousin got married and you were never invited. Actually, you were out of town and you wouldn't have been able to come anyway. So what's the difference? Well, I didn't invite you because I knew you'd be busy. That's nasty. So, Ivdas Hashem B'Simcha, whatever it is you're doing, if it's not B'Simcha, it's not going to work. So maybe Ivdu Es Hashem B'Simcha doesn't mean serve. It means succeed. Succeed with Simcha. Without Simcha, you're not going to succeed. Ivdu means work, working. It's not working without Simcha.
Yeah.